regulation after regulation and tax.
There are outdated regulations that need to be changed.
185,000 pages.
Without public accountability and transparency, there will be no public support.
Is this really the best we can do?
If there's a regulation that doesn't make any sense, why do you keep...
Do you know who wrote the regulatory laws you must comply with?
Welcome to the Regulatory Transparency Project's fourth branch podcast series. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker.
On April 4th, 2023, the Federalist Society's Regulatory Transparency Project hosted a live luncheon and panel discussion titled AI and Anti-Discrimination, AI Entering the Arena of Labor and Employment Law. The event featured opening remarks from EEOC Commissioner Keith Sonderling. The following is the audio from his address.
Good afternoon. Welcome to today's programming, AI and anti-discrimination, AI entering the arena of labor and employment law. We are happy to have you with us today. My name is Steve Schaefer, and I'm the director of the Federal Society's Regulatory Transparency Project. In order to get right to the programming, I will keep biographies brief. Note, as always, the Federal Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. I am pleased to introduce the Honorable Keith E. Sonderling, a commissioner on the U.S. Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. On September 22nd, 2020, the U.S. Senate confirmed Mr. Sonderling on a bipartisan basis to serve as a commissioner on the EEOC. As commissioner, Mr. Sonderling has published numerous articles on the benefits and potential harms of using artificial intelligence-based technology in the workplace and speaks globally on these emerging issues. Prior to his confirmation to the EEOC, Commissioner Sonderling served as deputy and acting administrator of the U.S. Department of Labor's Wage and Hour Division, which administers and enforces federal labor laws, including the Fair Labor Standards Act, the Family and Medical Leave Act, and the labor provisions of the Immigration and Nationality Act. We are pleased to have Commissioner Sonderling give the keynote today. Please join me in welcoming Commissioner Sonderling.
Thank you very much. All right. Well, thanks for having me. I'm really looking forward to this discussion today. And being a part of this panel, I think we're really going to dive into some of the trickier issues moving forward on how you actually regulate this and what businesses should be doing now and what the government's approach should be as well. But from my perspective, I wanted to lay out the groundwork of how AI is being used in HR. I'm going to go over some examples, give you a brief primer on the law, and then we'll get into the panel. So right now, as you all know, AI is all over the news with ChatGPT and everything else. And the reason is because AI is just very fast, it's efficient, it's making business decisions for companies in a way that's making them a lot of money. And that's a really good thing, right? So when businesses use AI in certain contexts and they see it's working, what do? They want more. And then what happens? More investment goes into AI, and you get it into all different arenas in the corporate sector. So whether it's making deliveries faster, widgets faster, you name it, AI is out there. So you have these smart computer engineers in Silicon Valley saying, okay, well, now we've, for the most part, figured out, hey, how to use AI in business. What else can we automate? What else can we use AI in? Oh, there's HR over there. Well, that seems like a very simple function, right? You know, most of people's experiences with HR are not dealing with the complexities that we deal with at the EEOC. So, oh, it's mainly getting forms and we can automate some of that. And that's good. Some of that can be automated. But then diving into what is the biggest problem facing HR? And that's the H in the HR, which is the human. Why? Because of the bias that has long plagued human decision-makings in our space. One of the reasons that the EEOC exists. So now, how do we eliminate that the human from that process? How do we automate that process? And as you'll find out, and as we'll discuss, and as the EEOC has been talking about, that's not a very easy thing to do, especially because here, when you're dealing with AI in HR, you're dealing with some of the most fundamental civil rights we have in the workplace, and that's the ability to enter in the workforce and thrive in the workforce without being discriminated against. So, and when I started talking about AI in HR, or I start talking about this, a lot of people just, their minds go to this dystopian future of these robot armies replacing humans, right? And that has caused, in a sense, for a lot of people to say, well, we don't need to worry about this yet. We're not, you know, having robots in our workforce. And there's a lot of stats that are really out there that are making the news, like the World Economic Forum predicts in the next 4 years, 85 million jobs will be displaced by some sort of AI automation. The Brookings Institute did a study, which I like to cite to you, because it looked at the Department of Labor's database. And in the Department of Labor's database, they have around 759 job categories. Of those 759 job categories, 740 of them have some near-term risk of automation. And we're seeing in the news that companies are buying robots. Orders are up 40%, and it's going to be cheap to do that. There's some studies out there that show replacing 2 to 3 workers every single year is only going to cost companies around $10,000. So most of the conversations about AI in the workplace relate to that. Now that I've said it, we're going to completely move on, because that's not what we're talking about today. From the standpoint of what I want to talk about today is how AI interacts with workplace anti-discrimination laws. And the issue is that HR departments now, like most businesses, have more information about their individual workforce than ever before. In HR, data is everything. It makes the difference between a good hire and a bad hire, a bad promotion and a good promotion. And what I'm trying to raise awareness of in this space is the difference between lawful and unlawful decision making. And the HR tech market, the spending is just tripling. It was $17 billion in 2021, and that's expected to go up to $30 billion. So it's out there, it's happening. It didn't happen overnight, whether you're aware of it or not. AI is being used in the entire employee life cycle. From the very beginning to write a job descriptions, AI screens resumes, it chats with applicants, it conducts job interviews, it predicts if an employee will accept a job accept the job they were offered, and then how much you have to pay them to get there. There's even programs out there that will tell you, okay, once this employee has now started, this is where they should sit, this is who they should interact with. There's software out there that identifies employees' current skills and potential skills. There's software out there that tracks employee productivity. There's sentiment software that every day will tell you if your employees are happy or not by looking at their Microsoft Teams or in their Outlook. And there's also software out there that if you fall short of your expectations, you get a message saying you're fired. This isn't my forward-looking prediction for each of these softwares. In all seriousness, there's thousands of programs out there for you to buy, with a lot of vendors happy to sell them to you. And the reason that we've seen these being so infiltrated so quickly is a lot of them promise to advance diversity, equity, and inclusion by mitigating workplace bias. So a lot of the larger companies that can afford this software, whether they're buying it on the outside or building it internally, you know, when you say, help me with DE&I, we have some programs to do it, how many millions of dollars can we give you to do that? So now, deciding for these companies whether or not to integrate AI in their HR systems is no longer a question. The question now is, how do you implement them? For what purpose are you going to use it? And more importantly, how does it comply with longstanding employment law? And you know, whether or not, it's a discussion for another day, whether this is a good thing or a bad thing, whether HR should be completely replaced, that doesn't matter to us, you know, at the EEOC. You know, but from my perspective, if AI is carefully designed and properly implemented, it really can help companies with their push to advance diversity, inclusion, and accessibility in the workforce by mitigating the unlawful risk of discrimination. So as most of you are attorneys in this room or close to this area, you know that workplace decisions have been vulnerable to bias. Again, what my agency does and why we collect around $500 million for victims of discrimination every single year. But there's some really basic studies out there that, you know, bias at the earliest stages of the hiring process. So a male and a female submit the same resume, a male is more likely to get selected. There's studies that out there that show if African Americans and Asian Americans whiten their resume, and what do I mean by that? They just remove any characteristics that would show what their status is, racial references, ethnicity, they receive more callbacks than when they're not on there than when they are. So a lot of times companies just don't become aware of this discriminatory conduct until it is too late. And this is where really AI can come in very early and eliminate bias at the earliest stages of the hiring process. An example I like to use because it's very simple, you know, you think about an applicant's name. An applicant's name, what does it tell you about the employee's ability to perform the job? Absolutely nothing. But what it does tell you is a lot of potential protected characteristics that the EEOC says you're not allowed to make a decision on, such as the applicant's sex, national origin, religion, or race. Likewise, there's a lot of programs out there that your first interview with a company is done completely on an app. So, you know, when you walk into an interview, whether it's now on Zoom or in person, that person who's interviewing sees a lot about you, right? They see you. And again, all those factors, you know, you cannot make an employment decision on. So it can help with intentional discrimination at the earliest phases of the hiring process, because if you're looking at the words the candidate says, how they're responding to your question, you can't see them. You can't see that that applicant is a certain race, national origin. You can't see that they're pregnant, disabled, or religiously observant. Because no matter what, you know, you have two candidates. How do you know if a hiring manager just doesn't hire somebody who's not disabled and goes with somebody else and say, well, you're equally qualified? You don't know that decision, because they'll just say we went with a more qualified candidate, but in reality, they may have been making that unlawful decision. So at least, you know, using AI at the earliest stages, that doesn't happen and that person can get further than they were before. So now I'll flip everything I just said. And at the same time, if AI is poorly designed and carelessly implemented, it can discriminate on a scale and magnitude far greater than any individual HR professional. Because like any bad HR decision, poor uses of artificial intelligence can damage the trust in the organization that uses it, create a toxic culture, and then hurt the profitability of the company, which is why the AI programs were bought. So AI is only as good as its purposeful and insightful application by the companies that are actually using it. And the big part of AI, and this is not unique in the HR space, it's just easy to understand in this space, it's only as good, AI is only as good as the training data on which the algorithms rely. And what does that mean in our space? It means who's the applicant pool, who are the employees. So for example, an algorithm that relies solely on the characteristics of a company's current workforce to model the attributes of the ideal candidate will just replicate the status quo. So if the workforce is made up of primarily of employees of one race, gender, national origin, you pick the protected characteristics, the algorithm is going to just automatically screen out those people. And, you know, the most infamous example of this point, and it's widely used in the AI space, and who knows if it's even truer anymore. The legend goes that one of these companies went to an AI vendor to diversify their workforce, and they said, here are my best people in this position. Go use your fancy machine learning, your fancy computers, and find what makes them so great. You know, without bias, without, let the computers make that decision. And the resume screening company using AI used machine learning, look at the patterns, and they came back and they said the most likely indicators of success at your company is being named Jared and having played high school lacrosse. Now, a lot of you may have heard this one already because it's widely used, but it just shows you why that was, because that's the pool they were looking at as well. So at the EEOC, our mission is to prevent and remedy employment discrimination and advance equal opportunity for all in the workplace. Many of the laws that we're going to discuss predate AI by over half a century, but it's really important from my position to make sure that anyone who is using AI or being subject to AI know that these laws apply equally to AI systems as they've done since they have been since they were enacted in the 1960s. So I need to just give a brief law school lesson here for those of you who don't practice labor and employment law. Then I promise I'll give you some examples, and Aram can grade me because he is a dean at GW. But you know, essentially, to keep it simple, there's two theories of discrimination under our laws: intentional disparate treatment and unintentional disparate impact. And one inquires intent, one is based upon a neutral policy that winds up discriminating. And what's really important in our space is that liability, for the most part, is going to be the same either way. So really, really simple textbook examples: a disparate impact. You know, a company just wants their workers to come to work on time, so the only qualification to work at this employer is living in the zip code next to the office. We don't care anything else about you, you just have to live in the zip code. Well, if the zip code is predominantly made up of a certain race, sex, national origin, it's going to have a discriminatory outcome there. Intentional discrimination, disparate treatment, very simple. I'm going through resumes. This resume is of a woman. I don't want to hire any women. Right in the trash. very easy. So how that applies to AI, and you know, we don't have a lot of examples of how AI is actually cases that we can report upon and discuss, and during our panel we can talk about some of the reasons that might be, is for the disparate impact that unintentional, there was an alleged, now widely used story from Amazon that they created a program to rate resumes for a certain position, and they used the training data on everyone who applied and was accepted to the job in the past 10 years. So they ran the machine learning, and then the computer was asked to rate the applicants from 1 to 5. If you were a woman, you were automatically rated lower than men. And they looked at that and they said, well, this is a function of the training data set because there wasn't many women in the data set. So automatically it looked and downgraded you based upon that characteristic. And this wasn't a proof of misogynistic intent on behalf of the AI. It was a function of the data fed to it in the first place. So most people in the AI community, whether you're talking about AI in employment, whether you're talking about housing, insurance, you name it, use that example specifically. Just, you know, basically garbage in, garbage out. Pretty simple. It's used widely to show how AI can discriminate. But what's not talked about is often what I'm trying to raise more awareness of is AI being used to intentionally discriminate. Now you may say, well, how can AI intentionally discriminate? Because it's, you know, there's no human involved. It's just making these decisions based upon those patterns. Well, it can, and this is something, you know, that, you know, when we talk later about some of the best practices of who has access to the system, because there's nothing preventing somebody to then go inject their bias into the AI system and then scale discrimination far quicker than throwing one resume in the trash. So an example of this is a case not filed by the EEOC. It was one that the ACLU brought against Facebook and other companies relating to their online advertising practices. There it was under state age discrimination law, where they said employers could use Facebook's tool that they use for other kinds of advertisements for products, which they can very specifically limit and show you the products, and that's how Facebook makes a lot of money in that way, but doing that for employment advertisements. And there it was alleged that it was limited to certain age groups. And, you know, the difference between advertising a product and advertising a job is that those are federally protected and you can't discriminate. So there, if you weren't in that specific age group, even if you were qualified for the job, you didn't see the advertisement based upon being in that protected characteristics, which was done through clicking and having the algorithm sort it that way. So the case settled pretty quickly. And again, we weren't involved in that. And they said they were going to take down the portal. But it's a good example to show with how, you know, just a few clicks, how discrimination can be scaled here intentionally. And even worse for the victims of discrimination, those who are on the other side, it goes even further than some of the pre-civil rights job advertisements that we saw before. So, you know, a lot of you have seen the historic black and white photos of job advertisements. If you haven't, just Google pre-civil rights job advertisements. They're pretty very, I don't want to say funny is not the right word, because, you know, at this point it is funny looking at them, but they were serious job advertisements. And the famous one was, you know, no Irish need to apply. You've seen that in the black and white photos in storefronts. Well, at least there you knew you were being discriminated against because of your religion. You knew that job opportunity was not available. And if there was civil rights at the time, then you would be able to exercise those. Here, it goes even further because it withholds the very existence of the opportunity based upon your membership in the protected class. So all those individuals who didn't see that potential job advertisement, who are qualified for the job and who would have applied if they weren't screened out because of their membership in a protected class, could potentially, you know, have been involved in that case. So you see how quickly, you know, these cases can get very large. So going back to the example that I gave you before, and with each of these, you have to look that there's significant benefits to them, but there's also significant risks as well. You know, I said a lot of companies are using, you know, your voice or the way you respond to answers, not the way you look during these interviews. So on an app, you know, they look and use machine learning through natural language processing, all the fancy buzzwords, to see the order in which you are answering questions. And again, that could be a really good thing because it can help have employers take that skills-based approach, which they're all looking to do, saying, here's how you responded to the question, and we're going to have our machine learning go rate you based upon the words you're saying. You know, well, the issue there is if the, you know, the transcription can't pick you up, let's say because you have a heavy foreign accent or you're disabled. So if you, I have a thick foreign accent and I give, you know, a responses and it only picks up 50% what I'm saying and I'm rated at below 50%, but somebody who speaks fluent English, you know, it gets rated at 99%, even though I was saying, you know, better responses and I'm more qualified for the job, I will be lowered basis upon my national origin. Or if I have a disability, if I slur or stutter, and then the computer can't pick me up, I'm also then being judged there as well. And that's disability discrimination. So you can see with each of this how careful employers have to be both on the purchasing side and the implementing side, because each of them can actually help remove bias, but also increase bias as well. And I will conclude with one more example before we get to the panel. Is that, you know, now with people returning to work, a lot of employees have gone to having a lot of some of the HR managerial functions done by algorithms. So your only point of contact may be with a chatbot, and that chatbot is telling you what to do that day for work. And that chatbot is telling you how many deliveries you need to make or how many widgets you need to make, which is fine. It could help, you know, make things go quicker, more efficiently. But at the same time, if it's automatically rating you without some kind of human intervention, or in the AI world, human in the loop, then it may not know that you're struggling that day and not hitting your goals and automatically lowering your performance review because of a disability, you know, because of a need for a religious accommodation or because of a pregnancy, all things, you know, which human managers walking the floor would see. And under the Americans with Disability Act, the manager or the HR department would then engage in the interactive process under the ADA to see, make sure they can have an accommodation while they're doing their job to perform at the same level. And, you know, there's not an algorithm sophisticated enough yet to know that this person is not performing well that day because of a disability or because of a need for accommodation that that human touch, that human element would be able to find. So, you know, this really, you know, tees up the important questions for employers, for companies, for designers, developers of, you know, what programs you're going to build and more importantly, how they're going to comply with our longstanding laws. Because as I like to say, our laws may be old, but they're not outdated. They're applying equally to decisions made in the 1960s with pen and paper as they are now to these products that are being developed, being used, or haven't been developed yet. And that's really important not to lose sight of, because from an employer's perspective, whether or not you intend to discriminate, if there is discrimination, that's what we're going to look at, whether it's done by a human, whether it's done by a computer, or a combination of both. And employers can't lose sight of that, especially some of the way that these programs are being sold. So I really look forward to our panel now. I hope this gives you enough information on how AI is being used in HR and some of the high-level legal issues. And now we'll dive into some of the fun stuff. So thank you again for having me.
Society's Regulatory Transparency Project, thanks for tuning in to the Fourth Branch Podcast. To catch every new episode when it's released, you can subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, and Spreaker. For the latest from RTP, please visit our website at regproject.org. That's regproject.org.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.